Access number 24925, reel 1.
This is the first reel of a taped interview with Don Anderson in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 25th of the 2nd, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Don, could we begin the interview by you telling us your full name and where you are?
My full name is Donald McColl Anderson. And I was born at 45 Broome Street, just around the corner here in Perth.
Cottesloe,
yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your family background.
Oh, well, I had my mother and father had three children. My elder sister, Marjorie, she was 13 years older than I was. And my brother, who was 9 years older, and I think I must have been a bit of an error, but I arrived very late in the piece. So, but all was well, and I grew up in the Cottesloe area. We lived at Swanbourne, on the hill there at Swanbourne. And my brother was sent to Guildford Grammar, because prior to being at Swanbourne, we'd lived in South Perth. And rather than break the change the school, the mother and father thought it would be best if he continued on going to Guildford Grammar. And so I was sent there too. That's the reason I had to travel up to Guildford. I was a boarder for a while, but mainly a day boy. And
what was life like?
Our life was, I suppose, really it was good. And a bit like the curate's egg, I suppose. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed life, and made a lot of friends. Others that went up to Guildford in the train with me have remained lifelong friends. And I enjoyed it there. I did a bit of gym and rowing and football and cricket, of course, nothing out of the ordinary. But I enjoyed my life there.
And were you taught at school?
Oh, we were taught English and maths and physics and chemistry and a little Latin.
What about history?
Oh, well, the history I learnt at school really was all, I remember it dated from the, we learnt the kings and queens of England as from James the First of England, Sixth of Scotland, and all the way through. We were told that we should remember when they came to the throne and when they. It was mainly English history, I suppose. Very, very little Australian history.
Why do you suppose it was so important to learn the kings and queens and the history of England?
I don't know. I suppose they had nothing else better to teach us. I don't know. I don't know. You know, when you're that age, you don't question what you're taught. You're just absorbed.
What were your thoughts in relation to England, given that you were a young bloke growing up in Perth, Western Australia?
Oh, well, I was always very proud to be an Australian. And I realised that it was always known as the mother country, England, although my father was a fourth generation Australian, and my mother was a fifth generation Australian. But they always had the feeling that England was there, and it was the original home, I suppose. And that's how we're brought up. That's how we're taught to think. And I suppose that's about the strength of it.
did you know about Australia in relation to things like the First World War and the involvement there?
Oh, well, I knew that the Australians had fought at Gallipoli, and I can remember from what I'd heard of the Australians at Gallipoli, I thought that there was no one else except Australians, until I found out later that there were 10,000 Australians or Anzacs killed, and over 100,000 British, and over 100,000 French, so it wasn't completely on its own. But I've learned about the Gallipoli and the trenches in France, and it was pretty dreadful, apparently, the mud and the slush and the loss of life. Five of my uncles were in the 14-18 war. My father was too old to join. He was born in 1871. So he was about 43 when the war started, and he was in some reserve. Well, he was in the bank, the manager of the National Bank in Fremantle when it started, and of course they were taking people up to the age of 36, so he was well out of it. I think he'd have liked to join the army or whatever. But, of course, as each year went on, he got older, and so he never went. But he always had a great admiration for men who went overseas.
Had you ever spoken to your uncle, for instance, about their experience?
No. I spoke to, yes, later in the piece, I there was an uncle I who came over here and visited, and he was at... He was at Gallipoli and in Flanders, and he told some pretty horrific stories about the whole thing. And I don't suppose it inspired me to go to war listening to all that stuff, but I realised that there are some things that you have to do and some things you do. And one of the things that you have to do when your country says you're at war is to go and do something about it. That's how I felt about it.
How was that instilled in young blokes? How did they instill that feeling in you?
Well, of course, it's hard to know when you're brought up how it's being instilled into you. I suppose. But it was always, God, King, and Country. Fear God and wash behind your ears, that sort of thing.
Serve the King.
Serve the King. And I remember saying once, I remember hearing once, I was reading some novel about the Royalists and the Roundheads and the Oliver Cromwell. And I said to my father, are you a royalist? And he was most shocked to think that I thought that he wasn't. And so there was that feeling. So I went along with what I was told.
In relation to the First World War and how it had been won, and who had been fighting, how did you feel? What do you know about that experience?
Well, I knew who who was fighting, and of course America came in, and in 1917, and I think, and that was a great push for the Allies. I think once America came into the war, the tide was turned. But I think it was very, very close. I think at the various stages in the war. And of course, there's this trench warfare where no one advanced too far or retreated too far. And it seemed to be a pretty messy business, that 1418 war, and people seemed to me be killed, slaughtered like cattle, really, without any thought of... I think things have changed now. I think they're still slaughtered like cattle, but in a better way.
In relation to the way the war had finished for the Germans and the Allies, how are things like the Versailles Treaty seen, do you think?
Well, I was a bit young for that, but I thought that from what I could gather, they were pretty harsh on the Germans. They had to pay for their errors and the reparations of the war they'd caused, and I believe things were very, very bad in Germany. I remember hearing someone say that you had to have a wheelbarrow full of money to go and have a haircut in Germany just after the war. But anyhow, I don't remember much about the Versailles Treaty.
What were the feelings towards the Germans, do you think?
Well, as far as I can gather here in the 1418 war, the Germans were really slapped down. People who are living here in Cottesloe and Peppermint Grove, if there's any hint that they were Germans, they'd be locked up in prison. And there are stories of people, well-known Cottesloe identities, being rumoured to have been signalling the submarines out of your absolute nonsense. You know, you wouldn't know where to point their message to. But I think things were pretty hard. They're very, and anyone with a German name probably changed during the...
In relation to the interwar years, how were people of German origin seen, do you think?
Well, I don't know. They all seem to be... I can't remember. They all seem to be a pretty decent lot. I remember we had a German wool buyer living next door to us in Swanbourne, and he, this must have been about 1938, and he would listen to Radio Germany, and he had married an Australian girl, and he was, I can remember, rather a fat sort of fella, glasses, and he was listening to Hitler. And his wife said, there were tears in his eyes, and he said, I feel so proud of Hitler and being a German. So Hitler must have had a pretty strong effect on people to get that emotion from them.
When did you become aware of Hitler and what was going on in Europe?
Well, I can remember hearing about Hitler in about 1936. And I remember saying to my brother, all the soldiers in the German army are trained to officer standards. And he laughed. He said, well, you know, all chiefs and no Indians. But I think the German army was pretty highly trained, ready to, they were thinking about war very early in the piece.
1936, they violated the Versailles Treaty by walking into the Rhineland.
Yeah.
What was the feeling in relation to that event, do you think?
Well, there was, from then on, I think there was a sort of a feeling that there'll be a war. Now, due to this, I think that there's a feeling that for quite a few years prior to the war, that there'd be a bust-up and something would have to happen. And a bit like today, people. I don't think people wanted war. They don't. No one anywhere in the world really wants war, but they felt it was in the offing. And I suppose really that It's very hard for me to say my views on war at the moment. I think that if our Prime Minister Howard, he's a democratically elected man, and I think he has the interests of all Australians at heart, and I think he has greater access to information about the war than I do. So if he decides to do something, I think it is for the long run and the benefit of Australia. Those are my views. And I suppose that was the feeling, in a way, prior to the war. I suppose some people joined up for various reasons. Nothing else better to do, I think generally speaking, there was a feeling of they'd like to do the best for the country.
In relation to the idea that war might be coming, obviously we look at a couple of things, and it didn't stop at Hitler marching into the Rhineland.
No.
It went on, and we hear stories of crossing into Austria and demanding the Sudetenland.
Yeah.
Was that broadcast very much?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. High news.
What sort of form?
Oh, well,
in the newspaper, headlines, big headlines. Austria invaded and all the rest of it. And then, of course, the big thing, Mr. Chamberlain waving the piece of paper, Peace in Our Time. And that was, I think, really, in a way, accepted with great relief.
Well, then, of course, it didn't eventuate.
I was going to ask about that situation in relation to what the feeling had been like.
What about, in what way?
On Chamberlain going away to Munich, coming back.
Well, of course, really, in any situation at all, you get 50% for and 50% against it. You know, it was pretty well evenly divided. A lot of people said he's wasting his time. But then there's always the group of people who say, well, there's a chance and that this won't happen. So I think in a way he was applauded, but I don't think that... I think everyone realised that England was just buying time, getting a bit more time before they're arming frantically. And getting ready for it. So this Peace in Our Time might have been a ploy for a bit more time.
In relation to obviously that time being used, that time being spent, and obviously the move into Prague in March of 1939, Chamberlain tricked.
Yeah.
War is on the cards, definitely, particularly as Poland comes into play.
Yeah.
What was the feeling then when you knew that it was imminent?
Well, as I say, everyone knew it was imminent for years, really, but it's just a matter of time. And I can remember when war was declared. I was in a train, and I had... a strange feeling that I thought, well, now here it is. And I think I thought that I must do something about it.
You're at the prime age to be involved.
Well, I was, you know, what was it? I was at, when the war started, I was born in 1922. So what was that, 20? I was 17. I was too young to get into the Air Force. But I'd put my age up a bit to get into Cameron Highlanders.
What was the feeling then of you and your friends on hearing the war being declared?
Well, a long while ago, but a feeling of foreboding, I suppose, of a feeling of this is it, and we must do something about it. That was the feeling. There was no feeling such as Vietnam or, there's no feeling that you wouldn't go.
But this was something that was happening a long way away from Perth.
Yeah. Well, you felt, I felt, we all felt connected to it. Australia at that stage was very much part of the British Empire, and of course it's not so today. But the feeling was there that it was we're needed. We'd be there.
What about the response from the community? Do you think, on a whole, to hearing the announcement?
Of course, shock. You know, it's a bit like the death of someone who's been dying a long while. It's always a bit of a shock when they actually die. And they knew that it was on. And then, of course, there's always the feeling that that the Japanese would come down and there was a.
How were the Japanese seen at that time?
Well, I think mainly they made very cheap goods, and anything that was made in Japan wasn't good.
So they weren't taken necessarily terribly seriously.
No, they weren't. If you wanted to insult someone, you'd say, "Oh, I think it's made in Japan." You got a present made in Japan. But of course, all that's changed.
So you were mentioning that you were to join the Cameron Highlands. What was involved with that, and why did you join the Cameron Highlands?
Well, my brother was 9 years older, and he had joined the Cameron Highlands, and I thought I'd do the same.
What about your friends? Did you speak to your friends about
that? Oh, yes, yes. A lot of them did. No, I think Alec. I don't know how old Alec Kerr is, but he'd be in much the same position. It was a bit of an adventure, and we all got our marksman badges for shooting, and which you had to be pretty accurate. We did that at school, we were in the cadets at school, and you did a lot of shooting and stuff.
Was it the sort of view that war was always a possibility, though you were being trained at school?
Oh, no. No, you weren't trained at school for war. It was just part of the discipline of the school. I've often thought, what's affected me in my life, whether it's your school or your family or your friends, but of course it's a bit of everything, really. Everything's connected. And I think the discipline we received at Guildford Grammar was good. I can remember someone was caught stealing at Guildford, and the whole school was assembled, and he was given 6 shots across the tail with a cane, and no one was allowed to speak to him for a week. Was sort of drummed in a message a bit there. No, it's not the thing to do. So I think that's it. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but that's what happened.
In relation then to joining the Cameron Highlands, you mentioned, I get the impression it was an enjoyable time.
Oh, yes. I remember going over to Rottnest, the camps, and to up to Northern, and the various camps, and we'd trek all over Rottnest Island. I suppose I can remember meeting McMillan over there, Rottnest, and you slept in a tent with 8 other people. You had to erect the tent, and you had to, when you finished, take it down and It was all new, you know. I'd never done anything like that before, and I enjoyed it. And there were a good lot of others.
In the background, obviously, training for a wartime experience. How did that make you feel?
How do you mean in the background?
Well, you're joining the Cameron Highlands as a militia unit, presumably to prepare yourself to go away and fight.
No, I don't think it was done for that. I think they've always had cadet corps, not with the intent of going away to fight. At least I never assumed that. I enjoyed being in the cadets. As I say, the good lot of others, and we had a lot of laughs, drank a lot of beer, and I suppose really that would be much the same as anywhere else in the world.
In relation to the situation, the Germans are again the problem. How did you see the German army in the early stages?
Well, they seem to be pretty invincible. They seem to be marching. I remember there was a song, "We're going to hang their washing on the Siegfried line." And that was quickly changed when they went right through and went, of course, to Dunkirk. But there were high hopes that the war would be over pretty quickly. But I don't think people in their heart of hearts thought that it would be a quick war.
What do you recall of Dunkirk?
Well, I can recall that several of my sister's friends were nursing aides there, and we had letters back from them. And it was they were lucky to get out. And the load of small ships that came across and picked these fellows up was a magnificent job. We all thought, that it was an absolute defeat, which Churchill, in his miraculous way, turned into a victory.
Had there ever been the concern that Germany would literally march through, get the war over and done with within a few months, and then invade England?
Yes. Yes. Well, they'd done that to Poland and Austria and France, or half France, and there was a feeling that it was touch and go. I was in England during the war, and in a lot of the bombing, we used to go to England, to London on leave, and see all the bombing, and there was a feeling that it could be touch and go.
There had been that period that people call the phony war, the period when not a lot actually happened. What was the feeling during that time?
Well, the feeling, as far as I was concerned, that the RAF were doing a marvellous job, and of course they're dropping leaflets and that sort of thing over France. And I don't know too much about the phony war, really. At that stage, what year was that? That was about 41.
Well, we're talking the period between May 28th, 1940, and the declaration of war. So that sort of period.
End of 39. From 39 up to May 40. Yes, well, I was still in the Cameron Highlanders there then, and my brother had joined the Air Force. He was on number one course. In Australia, they have various courses which are called up each month. And it started in April 40. And he had already joined the Air Force. And I was trying to get into the Air Force, but having a lot of trouble.
Why the Air Force?
Well, he was in there. My brother was there. And
why did he join the Air Force?
Well, I think that it was or I think or his friends were. He had a number of friends in the Air Force, and I think we'd all read a lot of stories about the air combats and the 14-18 war, and that's inspired us a bit.